big shout out goes to Maxxis Tires, Jensen USA, and Fox Shocks for supporting the Inside Line. Welcome, mountain bikers.
George Gomes, thanks so much for being on the show. Thanks for lending me the battery at the U.S. Open almost 2 years ago now. Stoked to talk to you about what you've been up to, how you got to where you're at. And can we clarify your roles here? Because you have Pro Builds, which is the team. You have Transition Factory Racing, which is a team. But you have Pro Builds, which is also a shop, right? Or like suspension tuning. Right. Can you kind of give us your official titles here as we kick it off?
So Pro Builds is a bike shop that's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Okay. That's kind of how the whole thing got started. Actually, I couldn't tell you which one got started first. They kind of both got started at the same time. Pro Builds Racing is a team that I actually own. And Transition Factory Racing is a team that me, Lars, and Transition Brainchild, yeah, we put that together.
Okay. All right. Cool. We'll dive into how each one of those things came to be. Cool. But yeah, you've got your hands full for sure. But I'm excited to dig into that journey. And, you know, clearly you're a man who has dedicated himself to helping up and coming riders, especially female riders. And I think it's time to give you some of that shine, like let the world know, because I don't know, I bet you go a little bit underappreciated. So I want to give you some airtime here and hear your story. And I want to know, we'll go back to the beginning, kind of where you're from, how you got into bikes and all that, to get you to a point of owning a shop, running two teams and all that. But, you know, how do you grow up and how do you find bikes, especially mountain biking?
First, can I start by thanking you for all the support that you've shown of Pro Builds and me throughout the years?
Easy. Yeah.
It's an honor to be on Vital, to be honest with you, dude.
Dude, cool. Thanks.
Yeah. So how we started, or how I got into biking, growing up in Jersey, you kind of have to have a bike to get around. I started skateboarding. So we used our bikes to get to the skate spots. Skate spots in Jersey were pretty spread out all over the place. We didn't even know that going to New York was leaving New Jersey. We thought when we went to New York, we were still in New Jersey. And that's how we got away with telling our moms that we were like in New York City and stuff like that, just trying to find skate spots. So that's how I found biking, was through skating. So
you could get from point A to point B, so you could skate?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I moved to Elizabeth High School, my high school was like one of the premier skate spots in the East Coast. Okay. So we used to get a lot of like out of towners that would come there. So then they would tell us where they were from, and then we'd have to like figure out how to get there. And our bikes pretty much got us everywhere. I couldn't tell you that probably pedaled hundreds of miles to get to skate spots when I was a kid.
Awesome. So all right, I'm going to ask this. Okay. Since you're from Jersey, like, do you know Mike Vallely then?
Yeah, for sure. That was like a huge idol of ours when we were like kids. I think I bought a pair of Doc Martens with like a summer saving just to shred them up because I seen that dude do it on a video. That's what he was skating on with Doc Martens. So yeah, I think me and two other kids in my neighborhood did the same thing, and people would look at us like we were idiots. But yeah, that dude was like an inspiration to all this, little Jersey hood rats for sure.
Yeah. So how do you take it from, you know, cruising around the city to getting on the dirt and, you know, going from there?
In my neighborhood in Jersey, when I lived in Elizabeth, we had like a hidden moto spot that was down the street from my house. It was like under the turnpike. All the neighborhood kids that like had any type of dirt bike, 50s to whatever size it was, they went back there and they would like just dig berms and jumps and all types of stupid stuff. And so eventually we started going there with our BMX bikes. Okay. And that's where biking started for me pretty much. Yeah. Huh, and shortly after I moved out of Jersey kind of right when that happened and moved to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which I don't know if you know anything about Bethlehem, but Posh Woods was
Yeah.
three blocks away from my house.
Oh, did you ride posh?
Hell no, bro. No,
Okay.
no, I went down there. All right. And when I rolled up, I was completely blown away because I'd never seen anything like that in my, moto track is like way different than, say, a BMX, and not even a BMX track, but dirt jumps for that
The
matter.
trails, yeah.
I never had seen one of those, right? So we get there and it's just like a bunch of kids in the woods, shovels everywhere and just holes everywhere. And I got introduced to this thing called the Superman jump, which was at the bottom of the back of Posh Woods, which was
Okay.
down like a really steep slope. And I think I was like on a borrowed bike and I hit it and crashed and pretty much gave up on BMX right away. So that was that for BMX. So yeah, so and then there was just like a hiatus for like a really, really, really long time. I didn't pick up mountain biking until, like to say, I was probably 27,
Okay.
living in Bethlehem still. Now, I always like kind of was a fan of it, like the Missy Giovies and all that, because you would see that on TV on like on what do you call it, the X Games. So that's kind of like where I first seen mountain biking, but the only mountain biking I ever knew of was downhill. Downhill, and
Okay.
then like later on seeing some videos like of Darren Bearclaw doing like some free riding and stuff like that. And pretty much from that point, I think I was making enough money that I could actually afford a mountain bike.
Okay.
So yeah, I got my first mountain bike at the local bike shop, Action Wheels.
What's it called? Action Wheels?
Sorry. Yeah, Action Wheels, yeah.
Okay. Any
So,
idea what year this is? If like the claws around you, like early 2000s, like
dude,
05-ish or
yeah,
something?
no, like late 2000s,
Okay.
like no, sorry, damn, wow, getting confused with my age and the year. So probably around, oh, it was the first P1, the specialized P1, so whatever year that was. So I don't know, 2002, three, four, right around there. Yeah, so it was like pretty late. Yeah, I got laid off from my construction job and had nothing to do, and found a like a Walmart, the worst Walmart bike in my father-in-law's basement, like a mongoose with a rigid fork on it. And one of my homies was like kind of getting into mountain biking at the time, like XCing, and I went out with him, and on that ride bumped into a high school buddy who was a real mountain biker, was on like a Santa Cruz Bullet at that time. And yeah, dude, here I am because of that day.
Wow,
Crazy.
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
So
was your first bike a P1?
yeah, it was a
Like when
P1.
you went trail riding on that bike?
Dude, I went to Mountain Creek on that thing like the
Oh my
second week I
goodness, are you
had it.
kidding? Yeah.
So if you could remember mountain biking in 2002, three, people were
Oh
like
yeah, for
wearing
sure.
rubber like spikes on their shoulders. It was like very
Just
Mad Max. Like
full armor,
the
yeah.
body armor was crazy. There was like Santa Cruz Super 8s, the little tiny wheels on the back. They look nuts.
Yep.
So yeah, I'm online and everyone's looking at me like, dude, you're gonna die today.
I
Because
bet.
I have like a bike with one brake on it. It has like a hookworm on the back.
Oh my
And
goodness.
yeah, that's my introduction to mountain biking, like at its core. Yeah.
Huh,
So
wow, that's cool. Well, obviously you survived because you're still here, but how did it,
yeah, for sure.
that didn't dissuade you from continuing to ride, I guess.
No, I think Mountain Creek kind of like really sparked like an interest on like what part of mountain biking I wanted to get into. So I kind of like, do I want a free ride? Do I want a race? Do I want to like just like participate? And I think it was like a few weeks into it, I went to my first US Open, which might have been the first US Open.
Okay, yeah.
and got myself on a lift with, at one point, Nathan Rennie. Another point, I forgot who the young lady was that was riding for Cannondale at that time. But throughout the day, because I was there by myself, I kept getting on lifts with like different athletes, and it was just cool to like hear people from Australia and France, and like I was like, dude, this is so sick. So yeah, my first race that I ever really seen was the US Open. So I was already like full on into it and addicted to it pretty
That's
much.
a good first race to see. Holy cow.
Yeah.
What, you
Yeah.
weren't on the P1 at the race though. Were you racing or did you just go to watch?
No, I was just like going there to watch and going to hang out. I didn't even know there was a race that week, and it just so happened to be a race weekend. And
Okay.
I think the people that like I was going with might have said that there was a race that weekend and they were going to go watch it. But at that point, like I said, the only racing I had ever seen was some racing like that I seen on the news channels when you would see like just kind of like a glimpse on a downhill race, right? And then the X Games when you would see it like live kind of thing. But
Okay.
outside of that, and I think Bryn Atkinson won that weekend, which was like, yeah, it was pretty wild.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you remember what it was like seeing riders of that caliber versus, what you'd been used to for the first couple of weeks of mountain biking?
Yeah, it was actually super insane because the one rock garden that they used to use all the time was like real gnarly. And being that the park is there, you can ride that whenever you want. And damn near just walking down that thing was hard, let alone riding a bike at Mach Turkey going through it was, totally like mind blowing. The scene was probably the thing I most was like taken by because like they have like a DJ in the middle of the rock garden. There's probably like 200 to 300 people just in this small little area. There's coolers of beer everywhere. People are screaming. It's just like the energy felt inside of that group. I mean, you ever been in a mosh pit before?
Yeah,
It's
felt like
like the
that.
mosh pit right before it's about to get like enraged. And it was kind of like I just wanted to be part of it. But obviously there's only one US Open, so I had to go get my fix in some other way. So some local racing. I did that,
Gotcha.
did some racing at Creek. But yeah.
Do you weren't racing on the P1, were you? Did you like
No,
upgrade to a
like
bike that was more capable? Like how is that journey?
yeah. I mean, so I went to like a Santa Cruz Bullet because all my buddies were on Santa Cruz's at that time. So that was like the bike that I thought was cool. And then went to like a dude, what was there? It was a bunch of Santa Cruz's, then into some intenses and finally got on a transition, which was where my relationship and transition started, which
Okay.
was
And how long ago was that?
due to possibly a good part of a decade, possibly going right on 10 years right now.
Whoa.
So
Okay.
yeah, I've been with them, wow, through a lot of bikes, a lot of different
Yeah. Well,
bikes for sure.
what was it back then? Like a TR500? It wasn't a blind side. Like a
Now it's
blind
like
side
a
was way back.
250, dude. Yeah, it was like a
Okay.
TR250, and then it went to a
Yeah.
450, and then a 500, and yeah, all the TR11s. So
Yeah.
yeah, it's pretty cool.
We're covering a big, portion of your life in a little short amount of time, but how do you take it from being a fan of racing? Well, I guess first, before that, were you finding success in racing? Like, did you have any goals of like, hey, I'm an expert now, I want to be semi-pro or pro and success like that? Was that your goal or was it just kind of fun?
Honestly, it was just fun. A bunch of my friends that we so we discovered a local hill and started digging on the local hill. That pretty much sparked 14 guys to come together and start a team. We were basically just like an excuse to get away for the weekend,
Yeah.
and go hang out on a mountain. And basically, it was just us racing against each other. We didn't even care how we did against anyone else. We're just bragging,
Okay.
right? So when we got back home, we could talk shit to each other. But
That's awesome.
I think the one guy that was running the team, Washer, was kind of like more of a professional about it. So he was the one that was going out looking for the sponsors and all. and getting us uniforms and getting them printed and all that. And I always thought that part of it was like super interesting. I was never, can say, like a good racer. I was good at certain parts of racing, but I was never good at execution, you know? Okay. So like I was good at like race prep. I was good at being like having kind of like a format of what I was going to do at the races. I wasn't just like doing things loose. And I was pretty decent wrenching. And I always was really big about having like a pit setup. You know, I always thought like the more you feel and look the part, the easier it is to execute it. And plus, like, I hated being in the rain, which almost like 100% of our races were always in the rain for some reason. So yeah, the evolution started from a little local team to another local team to then being picked up by a local shop from Philadelphia. Not local, I guess like Philly isn't really local to me, even though people think that Philadelphia is Pennsylvania. And the only place you can live in Pennsylvania is Philadelphia.
That's right. Yeah, right.
So, yeah. So Philly's about an hour away from me. And okay. A bike shop from Philly, which was like pretty unique. It was a bike and surf shop in Philadelphia, if you can imagine that.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Like off South 4th Street. If you know anything about Philly, like that's kind of like where you go to go party and drink, and it's really in the neck of it, you know?
Okay.
So ended up making friends with the owner there and riding for his shop for a little while. And he had, I think he might've been the only transition dealer in Pennsylvania at the time. So that's where the transition connection happened. So okay. Yeah, I started meeting some transition people when they would come out to Pennsylvania to do demos and stuff, and started making relationships with those guys. And yeah, slowly and gradually ended up meeting Lars.
Huh. Okay. Dude, Lars, the best. While you're doing this, you're working, you know, some kind of other job. This is all just kind of side for fun.
Yeah. So I was a construction worker, a machine operator for a long time. And, just really, I got laid off and really got kind of burnt out of the politics of construction. Your job is pretty much as good as everyone around you liking you, but it's also super competitive. So being a machine operator is probably the most competitive position you can have in a construction company.
How come? Just so many people want to be there?
Being a machine operator is one of the easiest, and well, not the easiest, but like if you're a good machine operator, it's pretty laid back job. You're in a machine all day long. If you're lucky, it has heat inside of it. And you're pretty much, you're controlling the pace of the job. So it's super exciting. It's a lot of responsibility. And like during that time, I was like trying to think of these ideas of how to like take this and get into like some sort of mountain biking. To be honest with you, a bunch of years back, I was trying to start a company to trail build. So I was already in talks with Camelback Mountain, which is a local mountain near me, about starting a mountain bike park. And it just never picked up. And the construction thing was kind of getting really burnt out for me. And when I got laid off during that time, I had saved some money and decided for some crazy reason to go work at a bike shop for $11 an hour. So it wasn't like I was going there for the money. It was more like I needed a change of pace. I really loved mountain biking. I really loved wrenching, but I didn't have quite the right experience for it. So yeah, I went and worked at a bike shop for a bunch of time.
I mean, is that where you learned suspension tuning and getting more, you know, deeply tied into working on a bike and taking it to a World Cup level?
No, I ended up wanting to take a bunch of clinics and ended up leaving the bike shop and starting to do just like my own stuff on the side. During that time, I had met a lady from Walmart who seen me out at an event working. This lady happened to be a regional manager for Walmart,
Okay.
asked me if I'd be interested in starting a company where I'd be building bikes for Walmarts. All right. If you could follow
Really?
this.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. I swear to God, it's the craziest story ever.
So
So,
I it sounds like a job that's necessary to some degree, but okay, go ahead.
right. Well, I thought bikes from Walmart just got built at Walmart, right?
Yeah.
So this lady proposes this idea, like, hey, I'll get you started in here. I'll get you in the right lane to get you in there, because it's super hard to get into Walmart. You really kind of need to know somebody in there. And she got me set up with an account with a vendor number, which is super hard to get in a Walmart. And pretty much at that point, she gave me all her accounts. She was just like, here, you can have as many stores as you want in Pennsylvania. Go and start building bikes for Walmarts. And I did that for a really long time. And during that period of time is kind of like where the team thing kind of started, because the Walmart thing wasn't like an everyday thing. I'd be working, say, for 3 weeks nonstop, probably day night, day night, day night in different locations. And then I'd be like 2 weeks of doing nothing. So during the 2 weeks of doing nothing, I started picking up, like, I don't know, like other jobs, like rebuilding race bikes for people, because I started going to a lot more races, which then sparked the mobile bike shop thing. So during
Okay.
the Walmart thing, the mobile bike shop thing is going on, and people started asking me to do suspension. So right around that time, I ended up meeting Jim from Fox and Gabe from Fox at a I think it might have like at a national event. They were helping Aaron Gwynn out. So I basically did a clinic with them, got invited to go do a clinic, and that's how the suspension thing started. Started doing clinics with them. They basically Gabe invited me to go to North Carolina to actually go work at the Fox Center for a few days. Well, it was like 7 days, might have been 7 to 10 days that I was there with them, and we basically went through everything we could possibly go through, like a crash course. And that was right before COVID started. So just lucky
Wow,
enough, because I
okay.
think that was the last time they ever did that. So yeah.
Just squeaked on in. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah,
Can
dude, it was
we go back to the Walmart thing just a little bit? Because
Yeah,
that's
sure.
super fascinating. So store 153 gets 30 bikes in and they would call you up and you'd go assemble them all. Like, were you at the store? So you'd build them and
Yeah,
put
dude,
them on the
it's
shelf kind of thing?
not 30 bikes. It's like store 53 called you and there's 300 bikes here.
Whoa.
And their rack takes, I think, 120 bikes. So
Okay.
their rack has to be filled. And what they end up doing is just filling up the like a back room. Imagine, like, they'll just fill up a cage or they'll take a container, put a container behind the store, and just fill the container to the brim with bikes.
Okay.
My success in that is that I actually was a bike mechanic, right? So a majority of the stores, their problem was that they were getting a lot of returns.
Dude, 'cause forks are on backwards and brakes don't work. Like, oh man. Yeah,
Yeah, so you go out, you get buy your kid a bike, and they go to change the gear, and the gear doesn't go into gear, or it gets pulled into the rim or whatever.
Yeah.
So most of the stores I would go into, they would have a pile of just returned bikes. So, yeah, I started gaining a little bit of fame in the area because I was turning down the numbers of the return bikes, which basically was like saving them money, because
Yeah.
people don't really understand. Walmart doesn't really make money off of their bikes. Their bikes are kind of like one of those items in the store that you go and it's like the extra thing you buy, or it's maybe the thing that you go in there to buy initially, to then they put that at the farthest end of the store. So you walk through and you buy all that other stuff, right? Or at least that's the way I imagine it, looking at it
For
from the
sure.
marketing point, right?
Yep.
So they don't really make money on the bikes, because what I was charging them to build them and what they were paying for them possibly and what they were selling them for, there's no way they were making money. but they weren't getting them returned, so they weren't losing money.
Right.
But again, I got burnout from that too, because the lighting in Walmarts is not that great, especially in the back. It's not the best environment to work in. You know, you're working around a real busy store that doesn't really care that you're there. You know, so like, yeah, it just started becoming inconvenient, and the money didn't outweigh the fact that I didn't want to be there anymore.
Okay.
And at that point, yeah, I was pretty much racing almost every weekend with Pro Builds Racing, like just about every weekend we were going away. And I was even scheduling my jobs so I could make sure that I could be at the races, just because the racing is what was making the Walmart okay.
You know, okay.
If you could follow that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Was doing Pro Builds at that time, was it paying for itself the way you could set it up and organize it? Or was it just still out of pocket and for the fun and for the love? Like, had you got to that point where it was, you know?
I mean, yeah, Pro Builds, I don't think has ever made money, or the money it did bring in went directly towards the athletes. I don't, dude, if I even take a tire from the program, you know it's used. You know what I mean? Yeah. I've never, yeah, pretty much anything you ever see on any of my bikes, I purchase with whatever discount we get. Anything we get for free from any of our sponsors goes directly to the program.
Okay.
And that's the way I've always had it, just because that's the whole point of the program, is to make at least the parts, and well, at least your race kit isn't holding you down, you know? So that's the least that Pro Builds Racing can do, right?
Can you kind of explain at least where you're at now, and if, you know, if Pro Builds was the same back then, because you treat it like a development team to some degree, right?
Yeah. So in the beginning, it was really hard to get people on the team, right? It's a brand new team. And as far as like young talent goes, people would just get snatched up pretty quick, or they were kind of like, during that time, everyone was kind of doing their own little program. There wasn't much of a team scene, I would say, on the East Coast. There was probably like a few teams, like Defiant was a big predominant team in my area. And Danny Cycles was another team in my area. But it wasn't like there was like a ton of teams, right? So when I started my team, it was kind of like mixed with veteran racers that were kind of like at the end of their racing, mixed with some super young racers that were just starting. And the goal was to have the veterans help the young guys kind of like come into it, and then grow the young kids into their later years, and then possibly help them get into a bigger program. The idea was never to make Pro Builds a World Cup team later on or anything like that. At that time, it was just like trying to just help a couple of kids like through those years before they get their license or their first girlfriend, to see if they have the hunger for it. And then if they did, you know, hopefully my program helped them get to the next spot. And then as time grew, it, I think it was more like the necessity for it. So the team started in 2018, and by 2019, I was introduced to Valentina by Mao Estrada. So when it went from like, let's help these kids get to a program that possibly could get them to a World Cup, with Valentina, it was more like, maybe let's start focusing on how we could become a program that could help Valentina get to the World Cup. So it started becoming a little bit more serious once we picked her up.
Okay.
Just because she had huge, huge goals and huge aspirations.
Yeah. So, yeah. And she's from Colombia, right?
Yes. Yeah. So is Mao Estrada, who introduced us to her.
Okay. And so was she down there when you were introduced to her?
Yes. Yeah, she, Mao went down there to a urban downhill. I think it was in her local town. It was like in Manizales.
Yep.
And she might have been been one of three girls to compete in it. At that time, I was specifically looking for a girl for my program because we already had four boys on the team, and I just wanted to put a girl on the team. And he called me the day after the race and was like, dude, I have the perfect girl for you. And 2 days later, I was on the phone with her.
And then, so what would that look like since you're, you know, kind of like a U.S. domestic team? Did she end up coming up here, or was it just kind of a sponsorship, you know, abroad that she would do what she did down there and you just help her out?
I mean, the plan was to get her out here, but then COVID happened. So, yeah. That was that because Colombians have to get visas to come out to the States. It's not something that you could do overnight. Usually it's like very long process, like months. Hmm. Like you can petition for it in December and it could be July for your appointment. Jeez. So yeah, COVID pretty much stopped everything, which, as you can imagine, as a team manager, I'm not seeing her development. So it's very like from abroad, all our conversations are like this. They're over a screen. I'm just seeing results. I'm comparing her times to the boys' times, to the boys' juniors' times. And it's very much just like blind faith between me and her. She's just like, depending on me to get all the stuff that she needs, and I'm depending on her to, you know, do what her part is, which is go out and compete and be professional and everything. And from a young age, man,
Because how old was she back then? 14, 15
when I met her. But already she was like, you don't meet too many kids that are 14 years old pretty much already have a goal of what they want to do and where they want to be. Mm-hmm. I was doing some research today and just like to be prepared for this. And I read the post that I made when I first met her. And it was something along the lines of like, you know, we want to like help her possibly get to a World Cup one day. And to think that last year she won the overall.
For real. Like, yeah.
Dude, it's like insanity because she told me it was going to happen, you know, like very like matter of fact, you know, like if you trust me and you take this chance with me, I'm going to win you a World Cup overall. I promise you that. And crazy. Yeah. So crazy.
Yeah. For someone that young and that determined. Yeah.
Muhammad Ali, I'm sure when he was a kid, all of them, when you're going to be a great, right. That knowing and that like, that seeing that already at the end, I think is super important. Having the vision. I think if you don't have the vision, you're going to have a really hard time trying to get to your goals. And she quite literally, inspired me to like, kind of like, all right, this team is not quite there. And, for us to really go there, I'm going to have to really get our sponsors to pick up and to get really involved in this program, which they did.
Okay. After the COVID years, when, like at this point, like as far as we're talking, you'd only met her virtually, like you'd never met her in person yet.
Never. Yeah.
Okay. So when did you meet her in person for the first time?
me and Jack Rice met her on the same exact night. And I can tell you, I was probably as nervous as I am about this podcast. I hadn't met her, right? There was like all this buildup, to this race. We're in Lourdes in this little tiny town in France. We're just driving around looking for this hotel that she's at, cause she's going to come stay with us. Right.
Okay.
And, like in this little dark alley, you know what I mean? As dramatic as it could possibly be. This little tiny human, I don't know how tall she is, but she's tiny, like running down the street and like jumps into my arms. And it's like pretty, I don't know. It was like, it took me back because like, I didn't know how to react to it. You know, like mm-hmm. here's this little kid I've never met before. And you know, we've been making all these promises to each other back and forth, and it's just like, here it is, it's go time. And shit, nervous and excited, and really like just nervous for her, you know, because she, dude, she went into the first race with every, she thought, she was like determined she was going to win the first race. And she came in with that, like, I remember being at the dinner table, me, Jack, her, her coach, Steven, and a couple of the kids that were on the team. And she was just hanging over my shoulder, and she, you could just tell she was just, you couldn't contain her, you know? And I was just like trying to reserve myself because I didn't even, I didn't want her to see me nervous or, yeah, I'm a pretty emotional dude. So it's very easy for me to like lose it. So I got to kind of like, well, when I mean lose it, like tear up and get all emotional about a certain thing that's going on. So yeah, it was really hard for me the first day I met her. It was, yeah, I had to call my wife up later on that day and just be like, holy shit, this is intense, you know? Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy.
How'd the first race go for?
Not good. It went so bad.
It's Lourdes. So.
Yeah. Lourdes was, I mean, it was that year, right? The lines were hours long. You got to imagine new team, new rider. We're kind of like really fresh to this, man. That the schedule, I memorized the schedule and everything, but you get there and Valentina is very like prompt with time. She wants to be the first one online. She wants to be at that top, like getting a good 20 minute warm up before she even starts practice. She's super professional when it comes down to that. So first day is already like throwing some sticks into the spokes. You know, she's not getting up there 20 minutes before practice starts. The line's already immense. Registration was like hard. She had a BR registration. The line for registration was long. You know, like just like everything that could possibly happen is happening, you know. She loved the track. She really loved the riding. The jump at the end of the track was super big. And I think on run two practice, she took herself out on that drop. I got a call.
Like right at the finish, that drop right there?
Dude, yeah.
Yeah,
I was, I was in the pits and I got a call from the paramedics. Which is not the call. Well, first off, it's like a foreign number. So I answer it and it's the paramedics. And I'm like, dear God. And they're like, you have to come down here. It's an emergency. And I'm like, first, I don't know which kid it is. I have three kids out. Two of them are, well, I have two kids out. Two of them are juniors. So I don't know which one it is. And I get there and I can see Valentina and she's crying. She's like bawling. And the medic is already like, yeah, she might have broken her ankle. And there it is, race one, and we're out. So she wants to get back on track, and the doctor's like, you know, obviously, like, you can't. So basically, she begged the doctor to just, like, not send her to the hospital, to let her sit down for, like, two, like, for a little while. Just by luck, they ended up extending practice for 2 hours. So the 2 hours that we lost, we ended up gaining. Right. So now the doctor's like, yeah, her ankles, the swelling went down and she says that she's good. She's a freaking psychopath. So I'm like, I'm sure she's not good, but she's like, strap me up, coach, and send me back out there. I'm ready to go.
No way.
So off she went. Yeah. She went out there with a bum ankle and yeah, I think she qualified 9th and ended up 10th.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't the result she wants. She cried a bunch. She's super angry a bunch. She was not happy with herself. And I mean, none of the kids that weekend did well. Andy crashed on his race run. Matt crashed on the first run of practice and went to the hospital. He really got hurt. Oh. So our first debut as a team, not what we expected.
Pretty rough.
And Yeah, it was super rough, and that race had this huge break to the next race. So like we went home kind of like with our tail between our legs. And yeah, it was like demoralizing. You know, we had big hopes. Andy at that point was the second fastest junior in the United States. Matt was my most experienced rider on the team. And yeah, like I said, everyone was really upset. And yeah, it wasn't good. So.
How'd you turn it around? I mean, obviously, like, you know, now we know things worked out pretty good, but it seems like that's a like a symptom of a champion if they can handle disappointment and defeat like that and come back and work through it. So what was Fort William next?
Yeah, Fort William was next, and then we got kind of another wrench thrown in. Visas again, Colombians have to get a visa to go to Fort William. So, and it's real hard to get a visa for the UK as a Colombian. So
Okay.
we literally got the visa on Wednesday morning of the race. So there was no possibility of making it out there.
Okay.
And yeah, at first it was like we were going to chance it. I was just going to fly out there. But Fort William is possibly the second most expensive venue to go to. So we started doing the cost, and it was like almost 4K just to go do one race with her last minute like that, you know? So like, yeah, it just wasn't in the books for us. But we already at that point, I mean, we already made the decision from the beginning of the season that we were going to do a full season of racing. I always tell any parent that's gonna send their kid to World Cups, never do the whole thing where it's like one race, or we're gonna try two races and make a vacation out of it. For one, World Cup racing should never be a vacation. You know, World Cup racing should be taken super serious. It's everyone else is out there super serious, and it's really, really expensive endeavor. And if you've ever been to a World Cup, it's not quite the vacation you want to plan out. Usually the venues aren't in vacation areas. They're usually in resorts, but during the off time, most of the stores are closed, most of the restaurants are closed. And it's just like it's a race environment that it's intense, and you know, it's just different. So when we set out to do the World Cup, it was the whole entire season. Well, at least for Valentina, it was. And that's how we budgeted this season. And that's the goal was to be overall top five. Because me and Lars were already talking about starting a World Cup team. But Lars is very much one of those guys where you're not going to force anything on him and you're not going to push anything on him. It has to happen organically, naturally. So I knew if I got to a top five with Valentina at the end of the season, that it would be a no-brainer to start a team. And obviously Pro Builds Racing wouldn't be able to like really facilitate the funds and the support to take Valentina to the next level, you know? So I really needed like real support. Even though that season, like Mutt Society, which is our partner sponsor on Pro Builds Racing. They really helped us out a lot with the funding, transition the company, helped us out with some funding. So we had a small budget. When I say small, I mean like almost non-existent, but it was enough to cover her flights, you know? And then everything else, I just had to cover, you know? So.
Like you're just doing this out of pocket?
Oh yeah. I don't want to even throw out the number.
Yeah,
But
I don't
if
want
anyone
specifics, but like, but
yeah.
you're doing it because you believe in it and think it's going to go somewhere someday.
To say I believed in it is an understatement. I knew that at least me and her were on the right trajectory. And if you know anyone that's ever been around me and her, We're like two peas in the same pod. Super competitive, almost to a default. Sometimes it's not good. You know what I mean? I got to control my competitiveness sometimes. And super ambitious, you know, like once I decided that this is what I wanted to do as a career, it was the same thing as her. It was kind of just like, what do we have to do to do it? It wasn't about like finding the reasons to do it. It's like, we had every reason to do it. We just had to find the money to go do it professionally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think at one point I had a savings account and I was at the last of the savings account, and past that it was going into a joint savings account. All right. Okay. And you're married, so you know what that means. All right. So I had my savings account, which was a totally different savings account. And I remember Rachel telling me, you're at your last 2,500 bucks, dude. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I had still two more rounds to do. Had just got third place in world champs.
Okay.
So I was like, fuck, bro. We got to do it now. You know, there's no turning back.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'll say it now just because it's funny, but there was already rumors of teams talking to Valentina. And I was hearing it in the pits. There would be like other team managers that would be like, hey, man, we're hearing your girls talking. Not that she was talking to him, but people were already showing interest to her, you know? So at that point was like, shit, man. It doesn't matter where the season ends or where she ends up, but I have to finish what I set out to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was kind of just like, there was no objective to it at the end. It was just like, well, there was the objective of like finishing top five and finishing a promise I had made to her, which mm-hmm. was getting her to the World Cup and getting her on a factory team, regardless if it was mine or someone else's.
So you scraped by, obviously, made it happen.
Yeah. Jack can tell you that there was a pretty emotional moment, and me and him were sleeping in the van together for a good portion of 3 weeks.
And, I think I've heard this story.
Yeah. Jack was probably just about to kill me. Mm-hmm. We were pretty much, you know, down and out. Like, we were on the last of it. Like, Jack didn't know what he was going to do the next year. Yeah. I know what I was going to do the next year. Our golden ticket was about to leave the coop. You know what I mean? So we were like, fuck, what do we do at this point? You know, like, and it was like the same thing. It's like, dude, we just got to finish it and finish super strong and prove that, like, not only do we belong here, but like, shit, we did it with the like least amount of any support, at least amount of anything. Right. Like the true grind, you know? And, even though, like I said, he wanted to kill me, I think when we left the airport, we didn't say bye to each other. I think we like gave peace signs. You know, like,
no you way. Know what I mean? Yeah. A long summer.
It was cool now, thinking back then, because I really didn't know, right?
Hmm.
Even Lars, the conversations I was having with Lars right after World Champs, I called him up, like literally after the podium, called him up and was like, I know you know what just happened. So remember the bet we made. And it was like, you know, start making arrangements, you know, and I'm sure that sparked the fire under his ass, because he already was like thinking about making a team. Right. And he already had people that he wanted to put on the team. But yeah, I guess like it happened really fast from that point forward, but also super nerve wracking from that point forward.
I know Lars is pretty forward thinking, and obviously you weren't scared to take on, you know, investing in a junior woman, but it seems like they're kind of the smallest class. I know they're, you know, looking at it now versus 4 years ago or 2 years ago, even like they're coming up. But did you think about that at all? Like, hey, you know, like the women's class, junior women's class, isn't that big. We might not be able to find sponsorship versus, you know, like some fast elite male or junior male. I mean, like, was that ever a consideration? Because I think it's awesome that you took that risk, and it seems like timing wise, it's perfect, because without all these fast girls coming up and making the racing exciting, the sport would be dying. But now we're in a spot where there's a lot of fast girls, and Valentina is obviously one of them, and it's in a good spot. And it kind of seems easy now to look at junior women's racing and think like, yeah, there's something in that. But it seems like a few years ago, that might not have been the case. Like, did you ever wonder if that was the route you should go?
I actually thought the complete opposite. Years back, I thought, because the scene wasn't as big, I thought the potential in it was way more. And also, like, picking up a young Latin American, I thought would be perfect. I seen a lot of myself in Valentina. So it was easy for me to go talk to my sponsors about her, because it was almost like I was talking about myself when I was talking about her. So basically, I thought it was like super easy to get sponsorship for her. Like, when I called up Lars, I was like, hey, Lars, I got this young South American. Hey, what do you need? It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I need some bikes. All right, cool, bro. Let's get them to her. And called up. At that point, I already knew Jordy from Fox a little bit. I don't know if you know, but half of the staff at Fox, especially at that time, was Hispanic, especially in Jordy's department. So they were all about it. Like, yeah, let's go. What do you need? You know, so it was pretty much across the board, like Fly Racing. She was already in Fly Racing gear. Okay. Fly Racing, they were trying to like get into the market. So it's like, yeah, what do you need? To be honest with you, we were actually having a really hard time with getting support for the team until we put Valentina on the team.
Okay, so it was cool.
The total opposite. I don't know if maybe people already like seeing into the future. I'm not going to say I was already looking into the future, but Rachel, my wife, who's the team manager, she was the female that was on my team at that time. Rachel didn't want to race anymore. And I always thought the racing, the female aspect of the racing was really cool. And I always thought they weren't as competitive with each other. Still competitive, but really supportive within each other, which made their scene way more welcoming. And just an environment I kind of wanted to align myself with a little bit more. But in the States, it's really hard to get a female racer. I mean, anyone that's even a quarter way talented, dude, they're snatched up immediately. And I could tell you, I talked to every single female American, aside from the ones that were like sponsored. Like, I talked to all of them, and it was just, they all seemed like they had phenomenal support.
Okay.
So yeah, it was kind of like when I was looking for a female, like I said, even then it was just like anyone I would talk to, I talked to their parents and they were like, no, we're pretty good. The bike company's taking care of us. Coaching is taking care of us. This is taking care of us. I just don't think outside it like looked like, yeah, you would go to an ESC race and the class was like combined pro and expert. So there would be like seven girls, but I could tell you that the top three girls that were racing were probably on a free bike and maybe didn't have a mechanic or a team, but like definitely had a support. Dad's there, whoever's there wrenching, but I don't know, just, at least that's how it seemed from my standpoint. And at least whenever I would talk to somebody.
Yeah, that's super interesting to hear, because, you know, I'm kind of looking at it from out here, seeing result sheets or like there's four women on the results. I'm like, oh, that's not that many. It seems like things aren't going that well. But from your perspective and hearing that, that's super interesting, because I didn't realize that that's how it was. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, it also could have been because of the fact that there wasn't that many girls. So if you were fast, and you were like going to a World Cup, even if you were under the Federation jersey, there was an appeal to supporting that, you know? And as far as like the guys go, it seems like the guys always have so much support. At least from the outside, that's what it always seemed like to me. But from my experience, when I was talking to all, and I wouldn't say all, but I say a predominant part of the East Coast girls, when I was talking to a lot of the athletes to see if I could get them on my program, they all seemed pretty much like they had a lot of support. Valentina, obviously coming from Colombia, it doesn't matter, male or female, getting support in Colombia is dismal. You know what I mean? It's like almost near impossible to get support, especially if you want support outside of Colombia, like specialized Colombia, or not like Max's Colombia, or like, you know, like SRAM Colombia, that type of thing. If you want to be supported by the companies directly, it's really, really, really hard for a Colombian.
Well, kudos to you for help making it work. Okay, so we're going into 23, and we've got Transition Factory Racing now, right? First year was last year.
Yeah.
So what's that look like? How was the kind of the process of getting the team rolling and planning out what you're going to do versus what it was like with just pro builds? Do you have more budget? Do you have different riders? Like, your expectations higher? Like, what are you thinking going into the season last year?
So obviously we have a budget, which is great, but we had never done a team before. When we first started the team, it was kind of like one of those things that there was only like one or two riders when the idea started, right? And then it grew to a five-rider team. So going from a two-rider team to a five-rider team, we didn't really know how much a budget was going to cost. We didn't know how much anything was going to cost. Everything we were basing was off of the season prior. And the season prior, you got to imagine, I was going on a shoe budget.
Yeah, your shoestring for sure. Uh-huh.
Right. I mean, a shoestring budget. And that's – so I was kind of basing the idea off of that. Obviously, not staying in a van. We're going to stay in a hotel now, or staying in a house. Well, a house, it was the most affordable. But where do we stay, and how much does it cost to stay there? How much does food cost? I was getting food for 3 adults. Now I'm getting food for 9 adults. Oof. It's just like way different, right? The fact that the team started, the idea of the team started in possibly like December, right? And the plan went into effect by February. We were like, all right, we know what we're going to announce. And then we made an announcement. But like, dude, it was like a crash course for real going into it. Because there was, yeah, I mean, like, dude, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to a race. I'm doing the same thing at every event, right, that I would do at any national event. And we had like a couple of practice races leading into it. We had the nationals in the States. So we weren't going into the races like super unexperienced, but as far as the money part of it goes, the expectations and all that, we didn't know, man. You know, like the first race we get there, I have a group of new riders. Everyone's meeting each other for the first time. The only people that really know each other are me, Jack, Nick, Rachel, Valentina, and Richie.
Okay.
I knew Tristan from, I've known Tristan since he was 13 or 14, right around there, from the ESCs, from the Eastern State Cups. So I knew Tristan because he was always a backup guy on my pits at every single race. Because obviously Common Cell Muckoff isn't coming out to support him at a local event. So any local event that I was at, Tristan would always end up in my pits with his dad. So we always welcomed him. So I knew Tristan from that. But I had only met Tilly, Allie, and Taylor the day I met you at the US Open.
Whoa,
And that was
really?
pretty much, yeah. So I met them at the US Open. It was supposed to be like a test run, see how we all mesh together. And there was no like, this is the team or this is what's going to happen. It was like, hey, I want you to meet these three girls. Let me know what you think about them because I might quite possibly want to add them to the team right now, which at that point was only Valentina. There was no other, well, Tilly was kind of already in their roster of riders that they wanted to put in the program, but Allie and Taylor was still kind of like, we didn't know if that was going to happen or not. And so, yeah, I hung out with them that weekend, worked with them that weekend, and a few months later, we were talking about starting a factory World Cup team.
And then how do you take it to the first race?
Dude, the first race was Lenzerheide, right? Yeah, the
Yeah.
first race was at Lenzerheide.
So also not cheap.
Yeah, dude, it's not as expensive as Fort William, though. But yeah,
Really?
Lenzerheide is not
Okay.
cheap.
Yep.
Yeah, I found out that you get pitted by your standings, your team standings. So we are not an elite team. We are a standard team and we're a new team. So we
You have
were
no
probably a
clout.
quarter mile down the road from where the race ended. So,
Okay.
yeah, there's like a humbling part in that, I think. Like, yeah, our hotel was in the middle of that road. So getting to the pits in the morning was easy, but like the end of the day, it was like super humbling for everybody, even though it was a transition factory racing. Everybody on the team understood that we were starting from the ground. You know, this is a fresh program, fresh faces, some first time World Cup racers. You know, Emil, our mechanic, was first time World Cup mechanic. Taylor was first time at a World Cup, and Nick had only done one World Cup, well, two World Cups leading up to that point. So the whole, my wife, Rachel, who is the other manager on the team, she had attended two World Cups, but I think like, you know, you're it's different. It's not your team.
Yeah.
You got hired by a company to come take care of their baby. You know what I mean? So I had to treat it, and I would have regardless. I had to treat it like it was my Pro Builds team. So yeah, it was super hard, and it was a lot of stress on me, to be 100% honest with you. Lars was there first race. Ion was there. One of our biggest sponsors is there. You
Okay.
know, like,
So yeah, you want to put on a good show? Yeah.
yeah, not even a show. How about just do the
Just
damn
like
thing without
presentation,
fucking
yeah.
it up?
Yep.
Yeah, you know, like not messing it up, dude. I mean, just it was the first time we put the pit up together, you know? So yeah, it was like way different than everything I prepared for. It was all out the door. My notes, everything. It was like everything was happening so fast, you know. Lucky enough, we had been at Lenzerheide, so I knew where like the registration building was, right? That was like important to know that, because that happened real
For
early in the
sure.
morning, because the schedule last year was insanity. Like, to be honest with you, this year's schedule is way better than last year's schedule. You know, like, because like last year's schedule, we were registering the morning of track walk and practice. So
Okay.
like that's a lot to put on management in general, you know, let alone the kids. But like I'm out there in the morning like with a chicken with his head cut off, you know, like trying to get the pits ready, trying to get my mechanics ready, making sure my riders have a ride into the pits, making sure my staff is there, making sure the media guys are ready to go, and then making sure that one of the managers are doing what the other manager can't do, which like one person can't stand in an hour line waiting to register the athlete when I have to get the athlete up on the mountain by 8 o'clock in the morning to start practice, right? There would be
Yeah.
times where we're like about to send a rider up and they don't even have their plates yet. You know, it's
Jeez. And there's no way to get that done sooner? Or is it because it's the first race that it was more hectic?
Well, no, it's just like, I don't know. I think it was like that morning, just getting out there, timing, you know, each race that went by, I think we started dialing in our timing, started writing down like just a lot of stuff, how long it would take to literally ride the e-bike from the condo to the pits, how long it would take to drive the car from the condo to the pits, how long does it take to walk or ride your bike from the condo to the lift and then take the lift to the top and then from the top to your warm-up spot, how long does that all take?
Okay.
These are all things that I started, like, I was implementing the year before, but it was almost like the importance of it started becoming like real important, you know, like almost like anal about it, you know, like trying to figure out where the kids are 40 minutes before the time for them to go up for their warmups, right? Because like, if it's a 15 minute walk or 15 minute bike ride or 10 minute bike ride, you want to make sure that 45 minutes before they even have to start making a move, they're already like gears packed up. Mechanics's tool roll is done. The bike bag is all loaded up with the rims. And you know what I mean? Like, all that stuff just started becoming way more important because, you know, you put factory in front of anything. And the pressure gets immense, you know?
Yeah. Well, that sounds hectic. Would, in hindsight, and I mean, I don't know about budgets and all that, but like, you didn't have any kind of team camp early in the season, right? To introduce each other and to try it out and do things. Like, I've heard of other teams doing that. Like, okay, first race is in May. In March, we all go meet at, you know, Windrock and we pretend it's a World Cup and go through everything. Is that something you could do in the future if you need to? Do you wish you could do that?
So the first year we did two team camps. We did an initial team camp, like a media team camp. So everyone at Transition could get videos and photos so they could do their announcement. And then we did a SRAM test camp because obviously we were getting on, at that point, we were getting on the new black box fork, the new 38. And the new brakes. So we spent, I think, like 4 days with SRAM at Windrock.
Okay.
Leading up to the Tennessee National last year. So we got two team camps together, even though our
budget it wasn't like a dry run of a World Cup day or weekend.
No, nothing like that. It was more so just like get the riders on these parts because we had never ridden. So the new brakes and the new fork and the rear shock. So we were getting everyone on their parts. And I think we were getting like custom tunes. Also, Max from SRAM was giving each kid their own custom tune. So when we left, we had, say, 2 to 3 rear shocks that were tuned for each kid. And we went off to the races from that point. But I think at that point, we pretty much like, had a good idea of who we each were. And the only person that wasn't at camp at that point was Valentina because, again, we were dealing with visa issues.
Okay.
So, rough, yeah, man. Everyone met Valentina at Lenzerheim.
Okay. Kind of want to walk us through the results of 23 and some of the highlights, the lowlights. I mean, obviously ended up in her winning the World Cup overall, but, you know, give us a bit of the season, because there were some struggles with the format. There's semifinals now. There's, well, I guess juniors didn't have semis, did they? But
no.
But just there were issues with juniors and practicing, juniors and race results, because like Ludenvier, right? Didn't they get, it was qualifying that ended up being results. Like, you want to just kind of walk us through the season a little bit?
I thought you were just going to brush over that one. no, the season was what you would expect going into a World Cup. You know what I mean? Like, what did you think it was going to be? Anyone that's going into a World Cup thinking it's going to be a walk in the park, you're sorely mistaken. Definitely should probably not do it. I knew that there was going to be struggles. I knew that there was going to be big struggles. I knew that the challenge that we had ahead of us, because we had made big promises to our sponsors, you know, I knew that it was just going to be hard.
What were the promises?
That we were going to win the overall. We had called it in the beginning of the season. That was the promise. We were going to win. We were coming home with the overall. There was no other goal outside of that. Was that we were going to get the overall. So yeah, Lenzerheide started off exactly how you would think a World Cup would start off. Not great. You know, like great and not great, right? Valentina gets second place at her first World Cup. Well, not her first World Cup, at the first World Cup of the season. We were super excited. She was disappointed. She wanted to win because she qualified first, and that's how she wanted to finish it. Tristan got a flat. And Taylor made it into qualies and got ninth place at the finals, which was sick.
Heck yeah.
And that was how we went. It wasn't like the best start, but
it was pretty solid.
There was some highlights and some lows, you know. So it was pretty, yeah, it was eye opening, I guess. Lars is there, so he gets to witness this. Actually, no, dude, I'm getting Andorra and Lenzerheide mixed up. Sorry. So Tristan crashed the Lenzerheide. Okay. Yeah, real low. Sorry, I'm sorry, I messed that up. Yeah,
that's all right.
So yeah, Tristan crashed at Lenzerheide. Probably the scariest thing I've ever walked up on in my life. I was on track just above him, above the lake. And he had crashed just beneath the lake on the steep section, the real gnarly steep section. If you remember, a few years back, they had cut a tree. Well, the year before, they had cut a tree out of the way on the track in that steep section. That said tree was off to the left side of the track, just behind the tape. And it had like poking stick. Dude, it was like literally a vampire's worst nightmare.
I just looked at that on your Transition Factory feed. Yeah. Yeah, where he landed. Absolutely. Holy cow.
So the way his body landed in it was like he landed in between all the sticks that were protruding out of it.
Dude, yeah.
It was like some sort of a miracle.
Yeah.
It's like some sort of a miracle, right?
Hmm.
So, that happens to our elite pro male and not the way you want to start off a season. I think like for a manager, it's a hard thing to juggle, right? Here, Valentina got second place. Taylor makes it into the big show, makes it ninth place. And then you have this athlete that didn't even get to make it through qualifying, right? And thank God the injury was small. You know, it was only like a wrist. But still, like the whole buildup to what happened that day, like running down to him, I almost damn killed myself on a bike just trying to get to the dude, you know, and seeing his dad above him and the panic in his dad's face and seeing the medics looking up at me and this crowd around him. And it just looked like I was walking up to like a bad scene, you know?
Yeah.
That sat with me pretty much, I think, almost the whole race season. That stayed in the back of my head. Like every time I was on track after that, the importance of walkie-talkie started becoming almost like I need that walkie-talkie on all day long. I need to know where those kids are at every point in the day. Like, so if they get down through the finish line, I need to know they got through the finish line. If they go into the pits, I need to know when they're in the pits. I just started like panicking about the kids all the time.
Like just that they're your responsibility. Like you've got them out there and you need to make sure they're safe.
Yeah. Some of these kids are out there with they're not there with their parents.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the year before I had to sign a waiver. I was Valentina's custodial. I was like her parental
The guardian.
custodian. Yeah, I was her guardian for the whole entire race season. That was like nerve-wracking, just signing that piece of paper. And it was like a government paper that her embassy had a copy of, you know, like, and like this year, yeah, I didn't sign off on her because she's eight. She was like turning 18, but like still, like, you know, Taylor got hurt while she was with us at Mount St. Anne, and there was a pretty big crash, and her parents weren't there. And yeah, as much as you try not to get emotionally attached to these kids, it's super hard. You know, you work with them in and out, you travel with them, you're with them every single day, you're eating dinner with them, you're at their highest peaks, you're at their lowest lows. You know, it's almost impossible to not form some sort of like bond with them.
For
So yeah,
sure.
you're out there on track. Yeah, it starts becoming to the point where you're like, you know, the race run, I'm just glad. I first thing I want to know is they made it through. Okay, they made it through. Where are we at right now? You know, like, I just want to know they made it through first and foremost, and then worry about results later, you know.
Dude, that's rough. And can we talk about Ludenvier or Ludenville, however you say it, and the results of all that? It sounds like it was a
Sure. Yeah, sure,
pretty
why
much a
not?
shit show for everyone.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I'm over it now.
So to give some context, it was a World Cup where it was the first time they'd raced there, super fast track. Well, they got really steep at the bottom, and then the rain came in and made it so greasy that the officials said juniors can't race it, right? And so their
Right.
qualifying results are what'll count.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah, so like I said, I'm over it now, but at that time I wasn't, and I was probably one of the more vocal team managers, which it is what it is. I wear my heart on my sleeve and sometimes it comes out. But yeah, so we're at this race, new venue. Valentina's absolutely in love. Taylor is having the time of her life. Tristan also is pretty excited about it because it's a new venue and he just came back and kind of gives you more of an even playing field, you know. So yeah, we're on practice. Valentina and Taylor, they all look great on track, and we knew what the weather was gonna we knew that the weather was coming in. And we were ready, pretty much getting ready for it. We had every single wheel possibly known in the trailer set up with every single tire known to man. We had a wet scream set up, if you can imagine. We had a shorty set up, and we had a Asti guy set up, and we had a dry tire set up. So we were like set up for everything. So we were staying at the top of the mountain, and the pits were at the bottom of the mountain. There was no point in us setting anything down to the bottom. We were just going to start our day right off at the top and go with the way things were going. So pretty much, yeah, tires are ready to go. We're ready to go. And we sit through this storm. The storm was absolutely nuts. Like, we were staying at the top of the mountain, and it was like probably one of the craziest things I've ever experienced myself, like standing out on the porch and listening to the gusts and stuff. So next morning, the track is, I went out an hour and a half earlier than practice started just to get my feet on the track, and you couldn't even walk on it. It was beyond greasy. Valentina is from part in Colombia where it rains every day at 2 o'clock on the dollar. So the trails there are super hard packed and dusty. So as soon as the rain hits, it's grease. Same exact conditions. So I started smiling. I knew I was in for a good day. I knew we were ready. I knew we were prepared for this because this is something we were training for. So, yeah, practice starts up. Juniors are out in the field. And it was absolute destruction. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm not going to name names, but there was people that couldn't even make it down the track. And I promise you, I was on the walkie and I was like, this is ours. We're going to win this without a doubt. Valentina's hitting sections of this track that the elite junior boys, the top boys, are struggling with. She's just cleaning them, roosting corners. I have a video of like every single track coach on the one corner just cheering her on through this one section. Right. Taylor was struggling a little bit, but was still getting through the track, you know, and the type of person that you can't really phase that girl's mood. You know what I mean? Like she's pretty much happy and stoked at all times. It's like really hard to get her to break that mode. So even when she was sliding around, you could hear her like laughing and having a good time. So we knew that we were in for a good race. And like I said, man, we got ready for the worst of it and they canceled the race. And Valentina does curse. And I've never heard her curse like that ever before in my life. And she was pissed. Yeah. And I was pissed. And a lot of people heard my opinion. What, and
were you guys like at the start, like ready to warm up and you didn't know it was canceled yet? Was there something like that that went on?
So I could tell you that because I've already said this, so it's no secret. So I was at the top warm-up hut. No one was in there, not one person. It was like we were the last people to get told that there wasn't a race happening. So I'm up there, warm-up bike is up there. Everything they need is up there to go race, and no one's showing up, like no one. There's not even somebody at the hut.
Yeah.
You know, and I started making my calls and, you know, I'm on the messenger app with the other TMs and got the word that the race was canceled. And I was pretty infuriated because.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, it was real hard to get that morning going, you know, like. I think the drive from the bottom to the top was a good 30 minutes. And. Not that we needed to go down there, but like, imagine if we were at the bottom, right? We would have went through that whole thing and not been prepared. Probably would have made the situation even worse. But I think being prepared and being up there and just sitting up there and just nothing happening was probably what made me angry, was that.
For sure.
Because we were ready to go.
Yeah. I mean, if you didn't reach out and ask what was happening, would anyone have ever told you? Like you could have sat up there all
day? No, we got a message. We got like a message like within like 15-minute window. We got a message and then I got a response. So it happened like real quick, but it was just weird that like, say the top juniors, right, that we were racing against 30 minutes before warm-up start, no mechanics up there, no bikes are up there, nothing. You know, I'm not trying to claim conspiracy theories, but it was just weird that we were the only ones up there, like literally an empty tent. I have a picture of it. And it was just like, what's going on here? But I mean, fourth place wasn't what we were looking for. I blame her a little bit for even holding back, because as we learned that day, qualifying is a race run and we don't hold back on race runs. And you know, now that we know that that's something that, you know, because did that ever happen before? Was there ever a race that was ever canceled before? I don't think so, right?
I haven't heard of much. Maybe there's one where EC rode his down in his underwear with the just on his rims or something, because maybe they canceled it because it was too muddy. But that was, I mean, 25 years ago or something. So, not common.
Yeah, it was weird, especially like the year before being in West Virginia. It's like, really, dude? How many people were carted out of, how many people got carted off that mountain of West Virginia? You know, we're kind of canceling this. But I mean, it was a lesson that we learned and a lesson in keeping composure. And like I said, I might have been vocal, but I wasn't like out of control. It was just like, I think Jack was running around with a microphone and caught me right after the race, which was like, possibly good for him and you, but not good for me. You know?
But then you you took it on and succeeded. So how'd you move on from there?
Yeah, I think honestly, Valentina leading up to that point, I know I keep going back to her, but like, I think you're referring to the overall championship, right? Mm-hmm. Like she, I think there was an intensity that she was missing. Okay. And that showed in that qualifier, right? Mm-hmm. There wasn't the intensity in the qualifier, which she was going to bring out for the race run. But I think like, and I might be totally wrong about this, but I think that intensity was realized at that point that she can't, she has to like put it, not put it all out there, but she has to take that intensity into her, into every race run, you know, mm-hmm. let it be qualifying, seeding or semi. Well, that she'll have next year. But I think that intensity was lacking. And that race, them handing her that fourth place, you know, that definitely that sparked the, yeah, that sparked the fire. Sorry, not fourth place, third place. Standing up on the podium and looking over to the other two, knowing that in her head, she knew that she could beat them that day. She was convinced of it. Hmm. I think that didn't set well with her, and we talked a bunch afterwards and just talked about how like, hey, we can't, now there is no possibilities of winning the overall started becoming slimmer, you know? So now it's like, we have to really turn this up. We can't take these next few races, like sitting back, you know?
Yep.
So yeah, headed to Andorra, right?
Yep. That's a good lesson to learn so young and early in her career. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a hard one, right? Because, I think like trying to figure out when you peak, I think takes like a lot of years of experience, and peaking too early in your rate in your week might hurt.
Yeah.
But you know, like finding that right timing is, I think it like, just takes a lot of years of experience. And even though for such a young rider, she rides like a very matured veteran, I think, mm-hmm. or at least that's like what people have told me from the sidelines. I mean, I've even had Erin Gwynn tell me like, man, she really rides like super like her posture and the intensity in her riding is like right there, right? I think like all racers like kind of have like kind of like a balance and a buildup to their racecraft, and some are just more early to start than others are, you know? Mm-hmm. I think because Valentina's been around such structured riders, her coach is an ex World Cup racer. So he brings a lot of structure to her program. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think.
Who is it? Is it Marcelo?
No, Steven Sabelos. I don't want to mess up his last name.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm almost positive it's Sabelos. And he's been her coach for the last, I say, 3 years, almost as long as she's been on the team. I think he started coaching her a year after she got on the team.
Okay.
And he's been pretty much at her side almost the whole entire time. Hmm. We actually hired him on as a track coach for next season for both Pro Builds and Transition Factory Racing. Yeah, he brings a lot of experience, and me and him work really well together. I feel like where he lacks, I'm better, and where I lack, he's better. So, and then there's also the translation between me, racer, and mechanic, because Richie speaks Spanish. He does speak English also, but he's more fluent in Spanish. So mm-hmm. it's a lot easier to get the information passed down to the mechanic. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, last year we just started noticing he was primarily there just for Valentina as her coach, as her track coach. And as we started bringing them in just to help us out more, just, yeah, it started working out just better. And you can't be mad at having more eyes on track. The more eyes you have on track, just the more advantage you have. I mean, shit, some of these French teams have 7-8 guys on track. You know, there's cameras all the way up and down the track. So
yeah,
having one person outside of me on track is amazing, you know? Yeah. So yeah.
Cool. So where'd you go from the season? How do you end up with Valentino winning the overall?
I mean, it's the dream come true, you know? Dude, I don't know if you see a video of me at the finish line, dude. I'm literally about to have a heart attack, you know, because it literally came down to the last race. And I don't know how exciting racing can get, but that's about as exciting as it can get.
For sure.
You have to win, right? So there's no second, third, fourth, or fifth place. Aris killed it. So we had a win. We were right there at finals and points. And like I said, we made some big promises to our sponsors, and not that like anybody would have been mad about us not winning the overall, right? Cause we got a couple of podiums, but still bringing that one home, definitely just proves that, like, I don't know, how many times do you hear that? Like I can't imagine that any of my sponsors probably get 50,000 emails a year about like, hey, I want to do this, and hey, I want to do that, and hey, I'm going to do this, and hey, I'm going to do that. But I can tell you that some of the sponsors that we talked to last year that didn't get quite on the program, that weren't part of the program, had the same conversations with me that I had with the sponsors that are on the program now. So it's kind of funny to bump into those people later on and being like, damn, dude, you really did what you said you guys were going to do.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, man. I've never done too many crazy things in my life, you know? I can't imagine that I kind of take this one lightly, right?
Yeah.
Valentina doing what she did. She did exactly what she said she was going to do and exactly what she wanted to do. So as an athlete, you can't be any more prouder than that. As a program, yeah, it just shows that regardless of us being inexperienced, probably on one of the smallest budgets in the in the whole circuit, and doing it almost 100% heart, you know, really shows and proves that, like, all those big trailers and all the glitz and glamour, that's not what wins championships. You know, what wins championships is a solid team, people that are inspired by the people on their team, and people that have a limitless goal, you know, just like a limitless, like, outlook on what is really possible, you know?
Yeah.
And after what we did this year, I have no, like, doubt in my head that we can do anything at this point, you know? Yeah. Maybe not next year, or maybe, like, not the year after, but like that one MMA fighter said, maybe not this year, maybe not next year, but one year we will be champions, you know, like on the highest level, you know, that's my goal.
Yeah.
My goal is to have an elite title one day, you know.
Did the results from 23 impact what can happen this year? Like, were you able to, were people talking to you now that may not have last year, or did it just, status quo?
Picked up a few sponsors that we'll be announcing in the upcoming future.
Okay.
And with the industry, the way the industry is right now, it's not the year to be going to trying to get more money from sponsors.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, the way our sponsorship was set up, we would obviously get increments from year to year. With the expectations of doing as well as we did, obviously, yeah, we thought we were going to do that well, but did we know we were going to do that well? It was kind of like just more an idea of what we were going to do. So Was it easier to get more money? No, not really. I don't think right now it's easy for anybody to get like a substantial increment. Yeah, I wouldn't say anything, but like, yeah, we're all our sponsors are still supporting us more so than they did last year. But the costs for next year are also more expensive. Pick costs are more expensive. Flights are more expensive. The hotels are more expensive. Everything is just more expensive. So regardless of how much more money we got in the budget, it's already pretty much gone. So like right now, I think just like any other team, we're really working really hard to see if we could get some outside support that's not in the industry. Yep. Which also doesn't make it as much of an urgency when you're looking for those sponsors, because those sponsors don't really care about maybe getting on a jersey. I think to them, that's more like an old school thinking of getting on a jersey. It's more about a partnership on a bigger scale. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're working on some things and trying to work on some outside support just to kind of think, get ahead of the game. Cause I think for you to make it in the future, especially the way it's looking like, you're going to have to be bringing some big money names in for you to get the proper support for you to be able to actually go and race World Cups in the future. And, not scared or angry about that. You know what I mean? I plan on being in the, even if it was top 20 teams, top 30 teams, I don't care what the nomination of it is. I plan on being part of that number.
Are you saying that it's looking tougher to be a part of that because of the structure and the way the, like either the UCI or Discovery or whoever is like setting it up for the future? Like, you think it's just going to cost more to be a part of it? Or do you think it's just going to be harder to get other kind of money?
I just think in general, you know, no one can foresee what the industry is going to be like 2 years from now, right? And if it's anything like it is now, expecting the industry to support the sport, I think is a little ignorant, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no other sport out there where the so like basketball sales isn't what's holding basketball. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like NASCAR racing, it's not selling, well, possibly them selling Toyotas, but I'm sure it's like every other thing that's helping them promote the sport, right? Things like what the UCI is doing and the ESO is doing, you could look at it in a negative way and you could look at it in a positive way. Mm-hmm. If they're trying to make it so like one day there's a race series, like the Indy thing or like the NASCAR series that's on Netflix, I'm all for that because it looks like the money goes right along with that. Mm-hmm. Also, I feel like what we show, yeah, I mean, you're seeing it from the screen and you see everything that's going on and you're catching the race, but I think you're missing the personal aspect of the racing. There's no other sport that you could literally walk into within 3 feet of your hero, shake their hand, take a picture with them, meet their mechanic, and literally stand 15 feet away from the action while it's happening. No sport does that unless you're paying $500, $600, $700 for a ticket to sit on the front row. I feel like our sport is super special, super unique. 5 years ago, I said it. I mean, not that I was like can see the future, but 5 years ago, I said that like you could already see how the sport was changing. In the ESC alone, you went from 200 participants to 500 participants within 3 years. The Downhill Southeast, they had to cut their registration because they were maxing out at 400. The kids class was like 200 kids.
Yeah.
I literally was like, holy shit, dude. Not to say that I was going to make $1 million off of this, but I could see me making a career out of it, making a future out of it, making my team actually like something that I can make a future out of, you know, like And honestly, I'm so glad I did what I did then, because I feel like the last 3 years flew by. It just happened so quick. And here we are today, to the point where people are like, you got to get to the next level. You know, like that level isn't good enough. You got to go get outside support, you know, like, and then you go to a World Cup and you see like, I forgot what the name of the XC team is Rocky Bikes or Mountain. I forgot what the name of the XC team is, but they're sponsored by Ford. And it's like, wow, like, dude, it's already happening. So like, how do you get ahead of it, you know? So right now I feel like as small as we are, we have to think really big and already think like the big teams. And like, yeah, I don't want to go spend 250K on a trailer or in a truck, but you know, we have to start thinking of possibly one day being able to pick up an elite male and what that's going to cost and what comes with that cost. You know, you have an elite male that costs 150K. You can't have a 150K program to go along with that program. Got to have like 300, 500K in it to support that 150K rider. You know, every year that we go on, you start thinking about things that you could add to the program that are just like super beneficial to the program. Let it be anything, again, boot drying machines, his shoe drying machine, you know what I mean? Like
Dude, for
something as
sure.
stupid as that. Yeah, something as stupid as that costs $400. If you need five of those, dude, that's 2K. You know, and like when you start thinking a broader picture, I'm like, how do I make my racer's environment less stressful and more fluid? Because if you're trying to make a program where you're bringing in somebody that's been on a program like that, you know, can you imagine if I got the money to pick up a Loic? How the hell am I going to support a Loic? That dude has been under the umbrella of the biggest team in the world, you know? So like, if you want to have aspirations of being the best team in the world, you got to start really thinking ahead and really working towards that. You know, you know, and listening to LeRon's podcast and listening to him talk about how he started his team and not even knowing, I'm like, wow, he started his team the way I started my team, which was like from scratch, from the ground. And now he's the biggest team, you know, Common Sill Muck Off. They started that team in the garage, you know, like from the ground. So, you know, seeing guys like that and being inspired by those guys and seeing that, like, yeah, man, this is really possible. And hearing LeRon say that there's room for people like me in the World Cup, you know, like as long as you're passionate and you have the right intentions, there's room for people like us, you know, to be in the sport. And I think like that's what makes the sport great. It's like the community that's in it, I think, you know.
Do you worry about, kind of the scrappers getting left out?
Yeah. A lot of those, you gotta imagine, I'm not an elite team, so I'm with the scrappers. We're all the way at the end of the pits, so we're with all the scrappers, even the teams that have been around for a while that are still not elite level teams, but are UCI teams that have quite a history. I've pitted right alongside with those guys. And yeah, I mean, to think that, imagine my team, Pro Builds Racing. If we would have started later on, like right now, it's still easy for a team like Pro Builds Racing to get on. All you need is a couple of people to put some money together. You got 5K and you got the heart. You got a team, right? And you need the point, right? So if you could get those three things together, you got the formula to start a World Cup team. If that changes, obviously teams like Pro Builds Racing won't be able to jump in, right? So what does that look like for World Cup? I mean, yeah, starting these other series sounds great, but they have to be in place already.
Yeah. Yep.
I hear people say that, like, you know, I heard actually one person, pretty significant a person, tell me that we had to work on our series in America. And I'm like, dude, you're absolutely nuts. Our series in America is absolutely booming. Maybe not out west, but the East Coast. Dude, I could race. All right, when did racing stop? October? Right? I'm about to go to a race next week. How much of a break did I have? Yeah, I'm about to go racing next week. You can't hardly tell any. Me that. Yeah, there's, I didn't even have a break. I'm literally thriving in this. I could almost make a full-time job out of this. You know? So, like, yeah, it's like one of those things where, like, yeah, maybe in general, every single country could probably grow their individual nation's series. But I think here, the series is super strong. All of
them. Regionally, everyone is. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just think maybe it still goes unnoticed, probably still under the radar.
Yep.
But shit, I think to get, when you petition to be a junior American or a junior elite for the America team, good luck. Good luck. It is hard to get on.
Lots of kids. I bet.
Yeah. Even the junior girls is starting to get hard to get in there. Last year at a race, right before practice, we had a UCI delegate come into our pits and tell Taylor that she had to finish ninth place or she was not getting in the world champs team.
Are you serious? Because there are that many like vying for her spot?
Yeah, right before Val d'Isle, craziest track in the circuit. She's been getting built up to this track the whole entire week. Uh-huh. Right before her race run, she gets told that she has to finish top nine. Not 10, top nine. She has to finish for her to get accepted into world champs. So, yeah, imagine that. How crazy is that? For a girl to get into the world champs team, she had to finish ninth. Not first, second, or third, you had to finish ninth.
Right.
So that means that there was already, and I think there was maybe 14 kids with the America team at World Champs. That's a lot of kids. So
heck yeah, yeah, that's so good.
Yeah, it's not, USDH is definitely not in any hurting. They're not hurting. I mean, you guys just put out the schedule this today, and I was looking at it. And sick that Lucas is on the cover of that. But dude, that's a hectic schedule. That's so
hectic. There's a lot of racing. Yeah.
You as an American athlete, dude, you could commit to any series, really. You got to go to the ESC. Dude, you got 14 races you got to show up to.
Yeah, there's a lot. You know? Yep.
Yeah, so like I said, I don't know what it's like in every other country. But as far as I see from my view, looks like downhill is killing it. I didn't even hear about enduro, but downhill is absolutely killing it. Did you follow the New Zealand race this weekend?
No, I didn't. I just saw results a little bit ago, but pretty tight. That junior kid beat the elites, right?
Dude, it's absolutely insanity. Next year's girls junior racing is going to be so intense.
Yeah.
So it's like,
it's going to be pretty cool.
Racing is growing. I think the sport's growing, but I think it's still so under the radar, but that to me isn't a negative. I feel like it might be the right time for people to just get in, you know, like I feel like the transition factory racing thing happened just at the right time. You know, COVID thing is happening. The boom in bicycle sales is happening. Valentina gets a podium. It's like, I call up Lars. Lars is like, yeah, man, we got all this money. Let's go. You know, and it all happened. But shit, if it would have happened next year, it would have been like, dude, sorry, bro. You know? Yeah. And, you know, you think about it sometimes. Yeah, I got asked on another podcast, do you think you would have gotten the overall if it would have been Pro Builds Racing? And I got to be 100% honest. I don't think so, dude. You know what I mean? It literally took a whole freaking village to make it happen.
Hmm.
You know, like her mechanic meticulously working till like 7, 8 o'clock at night on her and Taylor's bike. Rachel just meticulously just like making sure that every little logistical thing was like right on point. And like, dude, rental cars would cancel. We'd have to have four rental car companies back to back to back just to make sure that we always had a backup. You know, houses would cancel our Airbnbs, and you know, like food is
Jeez,
in
dude.
different languages at every single rush at every single grocery store. You know, like knowing that we had to be at the grocery store the day that we got into the venue, right? Because I didn't know that the year before. The year before, I was walking into empty grocery stores. So, like, you know, making sure that like Emil, Richie, Jack, Rachel, Nick, Valentina, Taylor, Tristan are all like in where they're supposed to be, definitely like was like a learning thing. But I feel like without every single one of them being there, like Taylor, I think helped out Valentina because Valentina is very reserved, right?
Yeah.
Dude, you could hear a pin dropping at warmups last year. If I would be like, hey, Valen, do you want me to, and dude, no talking, earphones in, pointing, she points at stuff. When Taylor came in, it brought this other side out of Valentina, singing up at the warm-up. Dude, watching them both doing their warm-ups, dude, I cried, dude. There was moments where I was like tearing up, just like seeing this camaraderie and seeing like, holy shit, there's a team happening here. It's not individual people anymore. It's like all of us like coming together and like forming this beautiful like rhythm, you know, like, and like, dude, it like it didn't happen the first race. Lars could tell you, first race he came to, he probably thought, dude, what in the hell? Even though it probably looked like pretty okay from the outside, he was probably like, ugh, this is gonna be a rough one, right? And then he shows up, yeah, he showed up four races later, and he's like, dude, I don't know what you guys are doing, but this is it. This is what we want. This is what we've been looking for, you know? And yeah, it was pretty cool to like, not only Lars, the owner of the company was there the following race. So imagine the owner, his wife, his kid, Tilly, who's a junior on the team, everyone coming out to Loudonville and experience that with us. You know, they experienced us qualifying well and like not, still well, third place to me. That was great. You know, like, but qualifying, going through the storm and the intensity of the next morning, like how, like, you know, the owner was like, how are we going to tackle this? Like, are we ready? And the owner being like, dude, what do you need me to do? I could drive a car. You know, like, it was just cool because like no one was expecting Kyle to come down there and like, dude, I'm expecting me to hand over my TM pass. Go do what you have to do. Go schmooze. And yeah, I'll see you at the end of the race, right? No one was expecting the dude to like get his hands dirty. And, you know, it was like really cool to see like the meeting that we had in the boardroom at Transition and everything we talked about. And then seeing the owner there and seeing this like thing happen. And like, I don't know, man. I can't imagine what the pride is to see that being like, I feel immensely proud of the whole thing, right? And like I
You
said, dude, I
should.
wear my heart on my sleeve. So
Yeah.
I get emotional, right? So it's like pretty cool to see him and watching his family watch that happen and experiencing that with us. It was, yeah, the first year was, yeah, it was crazy, man. Yeah, I have a hard time talking about this too, because yeah, it was the dream come true, man. I mean, like, where do you go from here, right?
You're gonna
You
keep going
know?
up, and you should be proud. Like
Yeah.
you put it together, and you wanted it, and you got it, and it's awesome.
Yeah. No, it's cool. Especially like Lars sits in the background and no one sees Lars and doesn't see what Lars has to do and what Lars has to go through. And Lars is probably the most unappreciated one of the whole entire team. because he flies so low under the radar, you know. I get a lot of shine, even though you might not think it. I do. You know, you've seen me on vitals. You've seen me on videos. You've seen me on podcasts, you know, like, and Lars is kind of like, honestly, without support and his belief in me, honestly, this wouldn't have happened, dude, because a lot of it was just me telling him like, hey, man, she's going to do this. Hey, man, I'm going to do this. And like, even him meeting Jack and Nick, you know, like Transition is a media team. Like they're awesome at that. The way that they portray Transition through social and everything is just like pretty sick, right?
Yeah.
So
it is.
How do you take that on? Like the company's like, I'm asking, so what do you want to, well, how do you want us to approach the media thing? And they're like, oh, we love what you were doing with Pro Builds. Just keep doing that. And they're like, oh, okay. You know?
All right.
So like, you know, you work with Jack all the time. Jack loves direction. Jack loves when you tell him what you expect from him. He works way better when you're telling him what to do instead of like, expecting him to just like come up with something, right? Yeah. Nick is the total opposite. Nick is, you know, likes to take control of what he's doing, but then again, you know, he's trying to fill in pretty huge shoes. You know, like how do you display this project to a broader audience?
Yeah.
And make it look like we're not doing this like with a potato phone. You know, so
you've built a killer team.
Yeah, dude, Jack, I love both those guys. Like, you know, Nick was our team photographer before I met Jack. Nick decided he wanted to be more of a video guy. Mm-hmm. And we met Jack the day that he posted the picture of my little humble pits at the US Open. And
that's awesome.
He introduced himself as the new vital photographer in the East Coast. He was, dude, I can't tell you how proud he was of that. All right.
That's awesome.
And yeah, he was like, yo, man, I just want to like display you, you know, doing what you're doing, you know? And it was like super cool because like at that point, seeing vital as a fan, you know, as an outside person, dude, never thought, you know, like where I'm at now is almost like, I literally, sometimes I joke around, I'm like definitely living in the Matrix, but it's like, even at that point, seeing our picture for the first time with my van and the name of the team on a vital post, it was like, I don't know, it was kind of inspiring because like Jack and me were like on that same thing, you know, like Jack was like trying to make a career out of it, working every odd job he could possibly do, and then going to, you know, events like the ESC, which is like very grassroots, you know. So meeting him and being inspired by him, and yeah, just like, you know, they say like feeding off of each other, I think we've been feeding off of each other ever since, you know. Yeah. Like I'm wearing his shirt right now, dude, you know?
Look, man.
Dude. So yeah, when he gave me the shirt, awesome. I was like, dude, so stoked about it, you know. So, yeah,
I sent him one. I'm like, you can't wear a shirt with your own knuckles on it. You got to give it away.
Yeah, he was telling me, he's like, dude, is it weird if I wear my own knuckles? I'm like, bro, nothing's weird. Nothing we're doing at this point is weird, dude. Like, it's a miracle that we're here, dude.
It's because you've just done what you want to do and it's all worked out. So,
yeah. Especially like me and him, man. Yeah. Me and him have a very similar background. Just like I didn't grow up in Brooklyn, but I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. So grew up in the same kind of environment that he did. And yeah, didn't make the best decisions in life and found something I was super passionate about super late in life. But just like him, it saved my life, you know, like, dude, I owe this sport more than I could possibly verbally explain, what this sport has given to me. The relationships, the community, the aspirations to like do something greater than what I thought I was able to do. Yeah, this sport, two wheels, opened up absolutely everything, dude. Fucking insane.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I think that's a great place to end right there.
A big shout out goes to Maxxis Tires, Jensen USA, and Fox Shocks for supporting the Inside Line. Welcome, mountain bikers.